Trevor Zamparelli on 2FM
with Virgin Mobile. Go from scrolling through stories to creating your own. Freedom is calling. Virgin Mobile. Bring on amazing.
It is Thursday, the 30th of June. It is 10 past 11. I'm Jennifer Zamparelli and I'm with you till 12. Now, in April of last year, mother of two, Jennifer Poole, was fatally assaulted at her home in Finglas by her partner, Gavin Murphy. Now, he pleaded guilty earlier this month and was given a mandatory sentence of life imprisonment. Evidence provided in the investigation found that Jennifer had received various injuries throughout the relationship and that her partner had a previous conviction for assaulting an ex-partner and her mother and producing a knife. So in light of this, Jennifer's family are now campaigning for a law to be introduced in Ireland, very similar to Clare's law in the UK, which would see that a register be drawn up of violent abusers in Ireland. In studio with us today is Jason Poole, Jennifer's brother, to tell us more about Jennifer and their family's campaign. Jason, you're very, very welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jennifer.
I know it's probably a very difficult thing to speak about. First of all, can you tell me about your gorgeous sister, Jennifer Poole?
Jennifer was 24. She was a mother of two young children. She was a carer in the local community. She worked in summer projects, youth clubs. She was loving, caring, hard working, great cleaner. That's all she did all day, was clean, clean, clean. And she just loved life, you know. She loved her music, loved to dance, was at the learning how to drive. You know, you'd see the car come around the corner and the music be blaring and Jennifer be dancing in the car instead of minding the road. You know, that was the kind of person she was. She just loved life. She always had a smile. Even though we know now that that smile was probably just put on to make us feel that everything was okay in Jennifer's life. And her two young children obviously never wanted for anything. She provided for them everything they needed, probably a little bit too much. But, you know, they didn't know life was going to be cut short. And they're the kind of things you kind of cherish now, that they did have those years with their mummy and that they did get spoiled for the time that they were together. So they're the kind of things that's all we have left is those little memories.
Yeah. Things weren't okay.
Things weren't okay in Jennifer's life. We would have, as a family, been aware of some bruises and some marks and some things that, you know, you as a person felt that doesn't explain, you know, what happened to you. But she always had a story and she always kind of made sure that she prepared the story in advance. We know she ended up in A&E on a number of occasions and again, always had stories. You know, we found out, like, she told one particular incident that where he put her to sleep on the floor, from what the children have told us, that she went to A&E and she told them she fell down the stairs because that's how she was able to explain her bruising. Like, she lived in an apartment, she didn't have stairs, you know. But there was always a story, there was always a reason. You know, we found out she was buying this special makeup that would cover her bruises. So there was lots of things. And when you challenge Jennifer about them, she always, as I said, had another story because she always had to protect what was really going on. Because I would imagine, you know, for any abuser, they're in control.
Yeah.
And if he was aware that Jennifer was telling those stories, I'm sure Jennifer's life would have been a lot difficult that evening or that night when she went home. So a lot of times she put on this, I suppose, front or face to make it look like that everything was okay.
As a family member, as a brother, is it difficult to go there with a loved one? I mean, it's kind of like you want to know, but you don't want to know.
Yeah, it is very difficult. And we did want to know and we didn't want to know at the same time, because at the end of the day, for me, it was my baby sister, you know, and you don't want anybody to hurt anybody or put a finger on anybody, because that's not right. That's wrong. But, you know, I suppose for us, we were aware of small little things, nothing to the extent that we found out after her death. But we were aware of small things and you'd say things to her. But, you know, I'd say, like, you know, if that's going on, then you need to get away from him. And she go, oh no, that's what happened, or this is what happened, or I got the busted lip, I was playing camogie in the park and the slitter hit me, or whatever it may be. There's always a story. But I think on the week leading up to her death, particularly because she had ended the relationship, and on the Friday afternoon, she rang me and we had a long conversation on the phone about moving on with her life, and she was asking me would I mind the children for an hour or two that evening. She was going to go out with her friends for a milkshake because we were kind of still in lockdown, so she wasn't able to go very many places. And that was the last time I seen her. You know, the next day I seen her, I was identifying her in Connolly Hospital. And that's all we have. And then you ask yourself as a brother, could you have done more? But people need to want help. We can have all the services and we can have all the laws and we can have all the legislation that we need. But, you know, when somebody leaves their abuser, that is the most at-risk time for them.
Okay.
Because it's like, you know, if I can't have you, nobody can have you. And that's it. And that's how we feel about Jennifer's situation. She'd ended the relationship. She removed all these belongings from her home. And then 2-3 days later, she's dead.
So she had left him, and that was the most vulnerable time, as you said there. How did he get back into the house? Can you just talk me through what happened that
day? Yeah, we were told that really what happened was he had moved out. He had been removed from the home. She had packed all his stuff and she had moved him out. And he had contacted that morning to say that he needed a hot shower. And Jennifer, being Jennifer and the type of person she was, she would, you know, this was probably half of her problem, that she was too honest and too trusting and gave her time so,
forgiven. Yeah.
And she let him in to have the shower. And she left the home. And she arrived back because we were heading out to the beach. It was a lovely day. And we were heading out to the beach that day. And she went back to the house to get some clothes. And she never left the house alive.
Did you have to explain to her kids what happened?
Yeah, I suppose my mum and my sister arrived to the scene very, very soon after. Jennifer was actually still in her home when my mum and sister got there, because they had noticed, you know, 40 minutes ago she was sent for clothes, and she only lives up the road from us. And when they got there, the guards were there, the paramedics were there, fire brigades were there, and Jennifer was being worked on, as we know now, in the house, but was already kind of, she was dead. But they had tried their very best due to, I suppose, the circumstances, and she was removed from there. And I met the ambulance and the guards in Connolly Hospital. So when I got there, Jennifer was already there. And I was brought into a room with the doctor, and the doctor had told me that Jennifer was dead. And then I had to inform the rest of my family, who were kind of only arriving because they were coming across the M50 to Connolly. And then when the family left, the guards asked me would I identify her, because she needed to be taken to the city morgue. So then I had to go in and, on my own, and identify her. And then when we went home, then we had to sit down with the kids and tell the kids, you know. And it was very, you were still raw, you were still in disbelief, you were still in shock. But it was important to make sure that the kids got the information in a very kid-friendly manner, you know. And that was something from the very beginning, that any organisation or any supports that we got was to be honest with them and tell them, you know, it's not mommy's gone to holy God, because what does that mean? It's mommy's dead and mommy's not coming back.
And how old are those kids?
At the time they were 4 and 7, so wow. They're 5 and 8 now.
It's the same age as my kids now. I can't imagine saying those words, having to, you know, vocalize and verbalize that kind of trauma.
It's very hard, and it's very hard for a 4 and a 7-year-old to understand that. And that's why I think it was really important, you know, like we got a couple of hours as a family, and then, you know, the process begins.
Mm-hmm.
The family guard interviews, the kids interviews, the belongings, and making sure they had everything they need for them to carry out their investigation. And, you know, on any opportunity I get, I really want to thank the guards, because the guards done an amazing job, and got us, I suppose, within 48 hours, got us at least to have a murder charge. That it gave you some sort of, okay, let's move on. Let's now start planning Jennifer's funeral, because the last thing you want is to be in a situation as a family where the killer is still out there and you don't know what's going to happen next. And I commend the guards for all the work that they've done on that. And again, with the kids, you know, they were amazing with the kids, and the school, the kids go to a school in Finglas, Mother Divine Grace, and, you know, they have been amazing this year with the kids, and it's amazing to see how well they're getting on with the impact that they've had. But also, you know, there's not a day goes by where they don't ask for their mummy, or ask, you know, of her or about her, or tell us, you know, my mummy said I could have had this, or, you know, so there's always that. And that's what keeps you going each day. That's what keeps you getting up every morning, because the kids keep you there and they keep you going.
Tell us a bit more about your family's campaign and what changes you want.
I suppose it was very difficult at the beginning, because you were kind of listening to Jennifer's story and putting the puzzle together. And yeah, there was lots of pieces of the puzzle that just didn't make sense. That, you know, if there were certain things in place, that we wouldn't be in the situation that we were in. First of all, if we had the sentencing structures in Ireland where if you were given a time, that you do that time. He was given three years for a previous offence, but only done two. And if he had done the extra year that he was given, they would have never met. If he had done the time for the crime that he committed in the first place. Then stuff around barring orders and safety orders, you know, emergency barring orders lasts 8 days. I mean, the court system in this country at the moment, you walk into Dolphin House and you don't know whether you're going to walk out with your safety or protection order. If you don't have enough evidence, depending on who the judge is on the day, they may tell you to come back again. Or, you know, what you mean, he said he was going to do this, but he didn't do it. So you don't get your barring order and safety orders and protection orders. So a piece around that as well. And the big thing for us was that we'd have a domestic violence register similar to Clare's Law in the UK, because we felt that, you know, Jennifer could have walked into a Garda station, or the guards who were called to the house on a number of occasions could have informed Jennifer that this person was on a register for a previous crime, and Jennifer would be still here today if we had that.
Yeah.
Because the information would have been shared with her, or she could have sought that information herself. Or within Clare's Law, you know, family members who have really strong suspicion and concerns can go into a Garda station with, you know, taking all the piece into account to get the information, to be able to share that with your loved one. Because sometimes they listen to you a little bit more, their friends a little bit more, than they would listen to someone in authority. So it'd be nice to have that piece in the legislation.
Jason, do you think a lot of women stay in these relationships because there isn't enough protection and they stay out of fear?
There's not enough protection for them, and there's not enough services and enough places for them to go if they leave their abuser. And it's great to hear that the Minister for Justice has looked at this, and they're going to double the amount of safe houses and stuff that's available. But that's only a proportion of it. You know, there's a lot more needs to be done. There's a lot of awareness that needs to be done. Men need to be allies in this situation.
Yeah.
There's no point having legislation. We need to back it up with day-to-day information. We need to back it up with support. We need to have radio adverts. We need to have television adverts. We need to have people trained, guards, doctors, teachers, the people who are working with the children, who particularly could be sharing that information. We all know children, you know, tell you everything. So to have that kind of mechanism, and I know a lot of work in the new strategy will be around an education piece, but it needs to happen. You know, it can't be just, this is our next 5-year plan. We need to implement it, and we need to implement it as quick as we can to save more people from having to suffer the way we're suffering.
And it seems to be, as we've had a lot of people and speakers on from Women's Aid on the show before, and it just seems since the pandemic, things have gotten worse.
Yeah, I believe, you know, and this is something I said before, I don't know whether it has got worse. I think it's always been a problem, and people that have communicated with me in recent times, you know, some people are living in these situations for 20, 30 years.
Mm.
But I think what really heightened it was when people were at home during a pandemic and people had lost their jobs and people were working from home, their abusers were with them 24/7. So they were suffering a lot more. It wasn't just the slap or the hit at 9 o'clock at night because they've been home and the dinner wasn't ready. It was they're with them the whole day. So it heightened it much more because they were more, I suppose, available to the victim because of the pandemic. And I think that's what brought it to the forefront. And yes, that's why I think discussions are happening, because a lot of this happened. But we've lost a number of women during the pandemic to domestic violence.
Since beginning your campaign, have you seen positive changes? Have you seen it move closer to what we, or where we need to be?
I think we have, to some regard. I know, you know, organisations have always been there and always doing the very best they can do. The guards, to a degree, with the what they have to, I suppose, help them and support them carry out their role, has been you know, enhanced and will hopefully further be enhanced with the new strategy. But let's not be forgetting we've had two strategies previous to this, you know. So I'm hoping that this and very ambitious strategy that the government have, that we will really, really see a change this time, because, you know, people have come on board, politicians are all talking about it, but it's time to make the changes. We need to stop talking about it and we need to act, because if we don't act, you know, other people are going to be in this situation.
To go through something like this quite recently, how does a family cope?
I think, you know, I believe we had a very close family unit before Jennifer's death, and we lived a certain life. And I think since Jennifer's death, we've become even closer as a family unit, but our lives are very, very different. You know, you wake up some days thinking this has all just been a nightmare. You know, that you're going to see her walking in the door. And then there's days where you don't want to get up out of bed. And I suppose this type of work is what keeps me going as a person. But as a family, supporting each other, you know, we've been through a lot. Mm. Courts, with, I suppose, different issues. And, you know, you're kind of there every 3-4 weeks in relation to a murder charge. And you're constantly dealing with the guards. And they have, as I said, been amazing to us. And our family liaison officer was amazing to us as well. But you don't live the same as you used to. And each day is a struggle. And other families who have experienced this, I'm sure, will agree with me that, you know, that life isn't just the same again. You know, you go up and you're just looking at a bit of grass and a headstone with her name on it. And that's the only memory you have. Like, in Ireland, legislation needs to change in relation to all of those kind of things. Like, we're living a life sentence.
Yeah.
We have a life sentence that we'll never get parole for. But yes, Jennifer's murderer can be out in 16 to 18 years and move on with his life. We'll never move on. We'll never get Jennifer back. And that's the difficult part for us, that we know we'll never get her out. We'll never see her again. You know, our kids will never see her again, but her murderer will be on the street someday.
Has a chance.
Yeah.
I just got a lot of texts coming in, Jason, on this. Somebody texted me saying, "Oh, Jen, I'm crying. Listen to this conversation. This happened to me a long time ago and it never leaves you. Thank God I escaped when I did. That poor family, as a brother said, unless you admit what's going on, no one can help you. The excuses I had were shocking but believable. I know the family will never get over the trauma of what they're going through, and I hope and pray they get the strength to have some kind of a normal life." So sad to hear that domestic abuse is still happening. Jason, if anyone's listening who might be in a similar situation to what Jennifer was in, what would you say to them? What message would you like them to take from Jennifer's story?
I think they need to realise that they are the victim, that they have done absolutely nothing wrong. I think abusers will strip you down and build you up to what they want, and it's very hard to walk away from that. But to seek help, go to the guards, speak to their families, speak to the Women's Aid, Stop Domestic Violence in Ireland. There's lots of organisations with lots of supports out there. But also to family, if you see there's something not wrong, go and speak to them. If you're a neighbour and you hear things that are not right, call the guards. Because Jennifer did have all of that and she didn't survive. If you do plan on leaving your abuser, make sure you have comfort. Make sure you have a family support. Don't be on your own, because that's what Jennifer did. Mm. Jennifer left, you know, thought she could get on with her life, and that weekend her life was ended. So while you do take that step, and that takes a lot to actually get to that point, but don't be on your own in that process. If it is that you go and get your guardian order, your protection order in advance of that, do that. Have the supports. Contact your local Garda station, tell them what's going on, and let them be aware, so that if a call did come in, that they can respond. That don't be on your own, because there's so much out there to help you. There's so many supports there. But as I said, you know, you have to take that step yourself. And it's the most difficult step to take, particularly when you have been in a relationship for 10, 12, 15 years and there's young children involved. But young children are also victims of this. So you're not only saving yourself, but you're saving your children.
Jason Poole, I wish you the very best of luck. Please keep us updated. You can come back anytime.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming in.
Jennifer Zaffarelli.
Weekday morning from 9
on 2FM.